In this session, I want to begin by briefly explaining this awareness of awareness practice and then doing the awareness of awareness practice a little bit, because in a few days' time, you'll be doing this with Renato in the morning sessions. So this is the third of the three shamatha practices we're doing in this course. And this practice, again, many people find very challenging, but not because it's complicated, but because it's too simple. Because it virtually involves doing nothing at all. It involves being present, simply being aware that you're aware. That's it. And it's not something that many of us are familiar with, because we're always in doing mode. We always want to do something. We're always focusing outward and doing some sort of activities. We're very rarely in a situation of just being. And that's what this practice is just being, just knowing that you're aware. That's it. And in this practice, of course, like the previous practice, of course, thoughts, emotions, memories, and sounds and so forth will still arise. But in this practice, we're not paying attention to any appearance. Of course, we're not trying to block thoughts or block sounds or block anything, but we're just not interested in any appearance. So all appearances we just ignore. And the only thing we're focusing on is the experience of awareness itself. Just rest in that experience. And this practice has enormous benefits in our modern society. One is it gets us out of our obsessive compulsive thinking mode into being. So that's very good to start with. This practice, by resting in awareness, it gets us out of obsessive compulsive thinking, which is where we often get caught up in daily life. So we can get out of that into this stillness of awareness. So this is a good start. Secondly, that experience of awareness, of course, is completely still, and it's completely open and spacious. So it helps avoid also contracting around things, because we can stay in that open, spacious, still state. And if we rest in that experience, it's very well known that simply by resting in that experience, we can intuitively have an insight into the nature of the mind, which of course is Vipassana practice. So this is very much a bridge into Vipassana practice. And also, of course, the other great benefit with this practice is if we can get in the habit of resting in the stillness of awareness, we can bring that into daily life. Meaning in daily life, we can have that as our default mode of resting in the stillness of awareness. And then at the same time, we can engage in activities and have that basis of stillness of awareness. Whereas now, of course, what happens is not only do we engage in activities, we get caught up in all these appearances and get overwhelmed by them. Whereas if we can really rest in the stillness of awareness, we can have that sort of grounding and engage in activities without getting swept up and caught up and swept away by appearances in daily life. So enormous benefits in this practice. And as with the previous practice, it's very much recommended in this practice as well to have the eyes open, same as before. Any questions about this before we go into the practice? Anything's not clear? Sorry?
What to do?
Stop doing. That's the just be. Just be. Of course, we have awareness. We can sit and space out. We can sit and go half asleep. That's not the practice. So we're not practicing getting very drowsy and sleepy. We need awareness. We need to be aware that we're aware. That's it. Don't do anything more than that. Just be aware that you're aware. That's it.
Is it like different from tense?
Different from?
Tension.
Particularly in this practice, if we want to be able to do it well, we have to be completely relaxed. Completely relaxed. With tension, this is not going to work at all. In general, of course, in all the shamatha practices, is the basis of relaxation. But if we really want to do this practice of being, we need to be super relaxed, even more so.
And in before practice?
Because tension is going to cause a lot of agitation and it's going to get into doing mode.
Yeah, in before practice, when there was no thought, just being, you said that it can be because of tension.
In the previous practice, when we're observing the mind, so when I said there's nothing there in terms of thoughts, is too much tension, then can suffocate the thoughts. But here, of course, whether there's thoughts here or not, we don't care. We're not paying attention to any appearance in this practice. Appearances will still arise, but we just ignore them. Ignore thoughts, ignore emotions, ignore sounds, ignore sensations in the body, ignore all of that, and just focus on being aware. That's it.
Can you please tell me what do you mean? Focus on be aware.
Okay, let's do a little 5-second experiment now of doing it. So for 5 seconds, just know that you're aware. Okay? Starting now. Okay? Was that difficult? Did you know that you were aware? Did you know that you were alive? Did you know that you had consciousness? Were you aware of that? That's it. That's the practice.
Yeah, I mean, should I know that I'm here? That's it.
Well, not physically,
yeah. But
just to know that you have awareness. That's it. That you're not sort of passed out, that you're not daydreaming, that you know that you're aware. Generally, we're aware of something. You know, I'm aware of the bowl. All we're doing in this practice is being aware that we're aware. That's it. That's all we're doing. Again, people find it very difficult because it's too simple. It's too simple because it involves doing nothing. Just knowing that you're aware. That's it. That's it.
Can you please tell me the difference between space out and...
In space out, there's no awareness. Awareness is gone. Because you only know that you're spaced out afterwards.
Yeah.
When you know that you're spaced out, you're not spaced out anymore, are you?
Then you're aware.
Then you're aware.
Of something.
Well, that you're aware that you were spaced out. You're aware that now you have awareness. You're spaced out and then you go, oh, I was spaced out. But then there's awareness.
I'm aware about those, that I was spaced out.
Yeah, but here we're not interested in what we are aware of.
Yes.
So we have awareness of the thought of objects and thoughts. Mm-hmm. But we're just being aware that we're aware. That's all. That's it. We're not interested in any appearances.
I think what's the difficult is, the most difficult for me is that there's no separation between the mind and me.
Exactly. This practice is very non-dualistic. The previous practice of observing the mind and the thoughts, the analogy is like we're observing the sky of the mind and the thoughts moving through it.
Someone that is watching.
Yes, experiential.
Separation.
No. Experientially in this practice, there's no sense of being a separate observer because we're just resting in awareness itself. It's like being the sky. So experientially, there's not a sense of being a witnessing awareness. It's just resting in the experience of awareness itself. Of course, we can say there is an observer. But who the observer is Vipassana practice. In this practice, we don't care who the observer is. That's Vipassana practice. Vipassana practice is we go, who's doing this observation? And we're going to do this meditation tomorrow morning. We're going to ask this very question tomorrow morning. Who's the observer? That's Vipassana. So here we're not entertaining those questions. In shamatha, just be. Okay? So we'll do this questioning tomorrow in Vipassana practice.
My problem with practice is in the moment where I'm aware that I'm aware, I'm aware of me being aware, and then I'm not.
Again, you are letting the intellectual mind, that's an appearance, just drop that. That's commentary, isn't it?
It is.
That's commentary. So just ignore that. Ignore it. Again, we're not in this practice, it's not a Vipassana practice. We're not interested in knowing who's the observer, where's the observer. This is all Vipassana. So when those thoughts come up, just ignore them. Just ignore. Ignore those thoughts. Like every other appearance, just ignore it and just rest in awareness. And there will, a lot of this commentary will come up. Oh, who's doing this? It's another appearance, and just ignore that question. Don't entertain the question. Don't try and answer it. Just completely ignore it. It's just more blah, blah, blah. We're not interested in this practice. In Vipassana practice, we're very much interested in this question. But that's a different practice. Okay? Let's do the practice. So again, if we're doing, we're not in the practice. Stop all doing. Stop all doing. As an act of loving kindness for yourself, allow your awareness to descend into the body. And become aware of sensations throughout the body. And using the out-breath to relax and release any tightness or tension. The breathing flowing naturally and effortlessly. And with each out-breath, letting go of any thoughts that may have arisen. Happily releasing them. And allowing the mind to come to rest in the present moment, focusing on the sensations of the breath throughout the body. Now allowing the eyes to be at least partially open, vacantly resting your gaze in the space in front of you. Now simply release all appearances and allow the mind to come to rest. And simply rest in the experience of awareness itself. Not doing anything at all. Just be. Be present. Be aware. Simply being aware of being aware. All sorts of appearances will continue to arise, but now pay no attention to any appearance. Simply rest in the experience of awareness itself. And to help overcome any agitation, tension, or distraction, release your awareness into space, releasing all appearances, relaxing completely. And to help overcome dullness or being spaced out, then arouse and refresh your focus, sharpen your focus, being aware of being aware. not doing anything at all. Simply resting in the stillness of awareness. Hard to do nothing, huh? We always want to do something. What am I doing? What am I doing? I've got to do something. I've got to do something. Stop doing. Stop doing. Just stop doing everything. It's again, it's something we have this obsession with doing. Doing, 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 doing. And of course, we get caught up in all of this stuff and we get overwhelmed by it. So here is just being, just be. Just know that you're aware. That's it. Stop doing Stop engaging in any appearances. Ignore all appearances and just be. Be aware. Rest in that awareness, the stillness of awareness. That's it. Question.
I find it similar like the first one. I don't know. For me, it was mostly similar.
The first one is, if a thought came, we watched it. In this one, if a thought comes, we ignore it. We don't pay any attention to any appearance. In the first practice, we're looking at them directly. Thought comes, we watch it arise and pass. Memory, we're watching them. In this one, if it comes, we just ignore. Ignore, 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 ignore. Ignore all appearances. Ignore. Don't observe. In the previous, of course, we were deliberately observing. That's the big difference.
It's hard to shut the focus. Are you saying if you don't know where to shut it?
Again, even in the previous practice, is what we can come to appreciate in this practice is there's not a point. We don't have an object. This is shamatha with no object. So there's not like, okay, where am I being aware? You know, is it here, here, there? We've missed the practice if we're doing that. Yeah, we're trying to still focus on an object. So in this one, we just drop all of that. Drop all of that, and whatever's left over, that's it.
Is this rikpa?
Rikpa is a Tibetan word which is translated as awareness. Usually in the Nyingma tradition, when they use the word rikpa, that is synonymous with the very subtle mind. Of course, here we're not connecting with the very subtle mind. So awareness can be a very generic term, and that's how we're using it here, just to be aware of being aware. Or, in the case of Nyingma, it can be a very specific meaning, meaning just the very subtle mind. So are we resting in Rikpa now? No. Are we being, because we're in the coarse mind now. Our mind that is active is the coarse mind. So we're being aware of being aware at the level of the coarse mind. So in Nyingma, Rikpa, that's not Rikpa. Rikpa is the very subtle mind, which for us now is dormant, is not active.
But where are we at? I mean,
where are we at?
Yeah, this awareness of awareness.
What do you mean by where are we at?
I guess this is a Vipassana question.
Again, in this practice... In this practice, we're not entertaining those questions. That's Vipassana practice. The goal of this practice is simply to develop a calm, clear, focused mind. That's it. Nothing more than that. So if we start asking questions in this practice, we're not doing shamatha practice. We're in Vipassana mode. Well, that's okay. Then we do Vipassana practice. But this is not Vipassana practice. So we're not questioning here. We're not going, who's observing all of this? This is Vipassana. So if that comes up, ignore it. If that question comes up, ignore it. Any appearance, just ignore it.
I asked the question now after doing this, I was doing sure. It, but now I wonder. Well,
we're going to look at this tomorrow morning.
Okay.
We're going to look at this tomorrow morning.
Is it in any way connected with the heart space?
With the heart space. What do you mean by that? Well, technically, of course, mind or awareness is not located anywhere, because mind in Buddhism is not a physical phenomena. The mind is not here, it's not here, it's not there, it's not anywhere, because that implies physicality. So what you will find, the more we can get into this practice, is that you'll find there'll be less and less a sense that awareness is here or here or here, or because now we're grasping onto, you know, because usually we identify our mind as being here because that's where most of our sense faculties are. You know, our dominant faculty is the visual faculty. So it seems like that the mind must be somewhere just behind that, because that's sort of where it's coming in. So it must be there. And then, of course, then based on our belief system, oh yeah, the mind is the brain. So yeah, yeah, it's here. It's definitely because the brain's here. So the mind is here. But that's just, there's no scientific evidence to support that. Of course, the brain is here, but then to conclude, therefore, the mind is here is a leap of faith. There's no scientific evidence to support that. So in this practice, of course, it's a mental experience. We're resting in the mind or awareness. And so what you will find is that it really doesn't have any spatial. That's why with the eyes open, it can be helpful. Because with the eyes closed, we still have a sense that this awareness is somewhere in here. Yeah. I mean, that can be done for a number of reasons. One, of course, is that we tend to connect this more with emotions and this more with thinking. And so any practice where we're more working with emotions, you know, then we can sort of focus here at a very simple level. But, of course, at a much deeper level, when we go into, like, level of tantra practice, then a lot of times we're focusing in these particular areas because we talk about chakras and channels and so forth. But that's a very high-level tantric sort of approach at the deep level to focus here or here or here or here. But this is sort of not within the context of this practice. No. And I find that even though this is very subtle because it involves stop doing, I find many people really resonate with this practice for two reasons mainly. One is that experience of stillness of awareness is a big relief to the obsessive compulsive mind. So it's all, oh, wow, that's so nice. Of course, we need to be careful we don't get craving that. But that's why one reason people resonate with it. It's to get out of that obsessive compulsive thinking is one. And the second is that to rest in that, it really feels like coming home. And from a Buddhist perspective, we're on the way to coming home because resting in that, we can come to intuitively realize the nature of our mind, which, of course, is an insight into reality. So this is touching on that. And so that's why often people feel like this, they're really coming to the true nature of who they really are rather than all this mess, the conceptual stuff, for these two reasons often. But yes, very nice, good. If you resonate with this practice, very good.
You can say that this practice is like not paying attention at anything?
Except being aware. To know you're aware, that's it. The rest, everything else you ignore. Ignore everything else. Ignore all other appearances. Just know that you're aware. That's it. That's all we're doing in this practice. Yeah.
If I have to really fight with dullness, wouldn't be this meditation. So really I was just telling myself, you know.
So yeah.
But I was like really fighting with dullness.
Yeah. So I brought in here the two little things about the agitation, distraction, and dullness. So if you're agitated or distracted, then just because it's usually because we're too tight, then we just release, just sort of release awareness, release all appearances, and just relax. But if you find yourself going into dullness, then just sharpen your focus. Be aware of being aware. Go more into the experience of awareness itself. And together with that, what can help is with the eyes open, if we are agitated and tense, lower the gaze. If we're getting dull, raise the gaze. So if you're sort of down there, just raise the gaze up. That can help with dullness. Or if we're agitated and tense, lower the gaze. So that also is helpful. Okay. Let's go back into the text. And now we're going to look at this shamatha chart. So this is how to progress on these nine stages to shamatha. Shamatha is the diagram in the middle at the top. And we see the meditator down the bottom at the beginning. And as we saw yesterday, in their left hand is a rope. That's the rope of mindfulness. And in the right hand is the hook of introspection. So, of course, these are the two main tools of the shamatha meditator. The rope of mindfulness to tie our mind to the object, and then the hook of introspection is the quality control. And we see here the elephant. The elephant is the mind. The fact that it is black is symbolizing dullness. The monkey is symbolizing conceptual thought in general, and the fact that it is black is symbolizing this excitement, the most common form of distraction. And here at the first stage of practice, called setting the mind, we see that the elephant and monkey are running wildly ahead of the meditator, which means that the first stage of practice of shamatha, what we notice is that our mind is completely out of control, that we try to focus on the object, let's say it's the breath, we focus on it for maybe 2 or 3 seconds, and then we're distracted. And then often we're distracted for long periods of time, maybe many minutes, and then suddenly we realize, hang on, I'm supposed to be on the breath, and we come back to the breath again for another 2 or 3 seconds, and then gone again. And then, so this is the first stage of practice. And then often what happens is when people have this experience, they often think, I can't meditate. Because before we do this sort of practice, we often have this illusion that my mind is sort of okay. You know, I think I should be able to focus on the breath okay. You know, maybe I'll get a bit dull and distracted, but that shouldn't be too difficult. My mind's not that bad. And then, of course, when we sit down and try to focus and we're continually swept away again and again and again, then often people go, I can't meditate. In fact, I must be doing something wrong because now my mind is getting worse. Before it used to be sort of okay, but now it's definitely getting worse. And then often then what people do is they open their eyes and look around and everyone else in the room is very still. I'm the only one who can't meditate. I'm hopeless. Everyone else can meditate. I give up. If this is your experience, you can meditate. You're making progress. That is the first sign of progress, is to see how chaotic and out of control our mind really is. So you've made it to step one. Good work. Good work. This is the first sign of progress, is just to notice how chaotic and out of control our mind really is. If we patiently and persistently continue the practice and keep bringing the mind back again and again and again and again, we'll get around to the second stage of practice here called continuous setting. And so in stage two, we see now that the elephant and the monkey are not running so fast and they have a little bit of white on the top of their head. And this white is the factors of stability and clarity. So by stage two of the practice, we're noticing now that from time to time our mind starts to settle down and we can focus on the object a little bit longer. Maybe we can even focus up to 1 or 2 minutes on the breath or the object and then we get distracted. But even at stage two, we get distracted often for long periods of time. So even at stage two of the practice, we tend to be more distracted than we are actually on the object. But by stage two, we're noticing some periods where the mind is settling down a bit, and we can focus sometimes 1 or 2 minutes before we get distracted. If we keep going on our practice, we'll get round the corner, and this third road, each road has a name, the third road is called the road of mindfulness. Because by stage three, mindfulness is getting a lot better, and we see now that the rope of mindfulness is actually tied to the elephant of the mind. Meaning that now we can focus on the object much better. And by stage three, we can usually focus on the object for maybe 5 to 10 minutes at a time before we become distracted. And now when we become distracted, we quickly recognize that and quickly come back to the object. And that's symbolized by the elephant turning its head backwards, meaning that when we get distracted, we quickly recognize and quickly come back to the object. But now at stage three, we see the rabbit has come into the picture on the back of the elephant. The rabbit is symbolizing subtle dullness. Because here by stage three, we can focus on the object a lot better And if we get distracted, we quickly come back. So it seems like we've made a lot of progress and we may be even getting close to shamatha. But actually, even though our mindfulness is getting better, the quality of our attention still needs a lot of work. And so by stage three, now we need to notice this. We need to notice when our mind is beginning a little bit dull. If we don't pick up that subtle dullness, we'll sort of get stuck here. We won't progress any further. So now at stage three and four and on, we're noticing more this sort of subtle level of dullness and a subtle level of agitation. By stage four, we can now focus on the object the entire session without ever completely losing it. And by stage four, we can meditate longer. Of course, one of the key phrases in shamatha practice is quality over quantity, meaning it's much better to practice for a short time in a focused way than try and meditate longer and simply become dull and spaced out. So as a beginner in the first one or two stages, we're probably meditating, 15, 20 minutes, maximum 30 minutes in a session. But by the time we get to stage four, we'll probably be able to meditate easily in a focused way for at least an hour in a session. And in stage four, we can hold the object the entire session without ever completely losing it. So we can hold the object the entire time, but still we need a lot of work on our quality of our holding, of our focus. Because you may have noticed even now at the beginning, it seems like we can focus on the breath and think about breakfast at the same time. Nice little trick, that one. So that thinking about breakfast or other things is, of course, static, background static. And, of course, as a beginner, often the focus on the breakfast is the main thing, and a little bit in the corner of our mind, we're still holding the breath a little bit. But then slowly as we improve, we're more focused on the breath and less on the breakfast, but still we need to just be focused on the breath. And so that's what we're really doing over these middling stages, is improving the quality of our attention. And that's what we see over stage five and six. This is the road of introspection. So now we see the hook of introspection more prominent. Meaning now, introspection or quality control is not so much in the beginning. Of course, introspection's job was to notice if we're more or less falling asleep or we're completely distracted. But by stage four, five, six now, we're noticing any subtle dullness or subtle agitation. And often over stage five and six, the analogy that's given here is the analogy of a guitar string. If a guitar string is too tight or too loose, it doesn't play well. Likewise, if our mind is too tight or too loose, it doesn't focus well. So here, over the middling stages, we are constantly fine-tuning our focus. If we're too tight, we're probably getting a bit of agitation coming in, we relax. If we're too loose, dullness is creeping in, we sharpen. So we're constantly sharpening and relaxing to find that balance. And to find that balance is the great challenge here over these middling stages. And then at stage seven now, we see that the rabbit is gone. We're saying goodbye to the monkey. And the elephant has hardly got any black on the back left. So by stage seven, now we can focus very well on the object. And if any little bit of subtle dullness or subtle agitation comes, we quickly eliminate it. By stage eight, now we see no black on the elephant. Monkey's completely gone. So by stage eight, all we need to do now is put a little bit of effort to start the meditation, and then effortlessly we can focus on the object without any hint of subtle dullness or subtle agitation. And here we can probably meditate at least 2 or 3 hours doing in that way. And then we get to stage nine. We see the meditator with the elephant in the cave. Now the whole practice becomes spontaneous and effortless. That spontaneously and effortlessly, we can meditate probably at least 4 hours in a very stable, very clear way on the object without any hint of subtle dullness or subtle agitation. But still, we haven't got to shamatha. Shamatha is the diagram in the middle at the top, And here we see the meditator flying through the sky and riding on the back of the elephant of the mind. So those two diagrams are symbolizing this pliancy that we briefly mentioned yesterday, this flexibility or serviceability of body and mind. And so when we achieve shamatha, we achieve this pliancy, we achieve this flexibility and serviceability of body and mind. And to describe this process of how we get from stage 9 to shamatha, I'd like to read again from Alan Wallace's book, Attention Revolution. Here's a very nice description of how we actually achieve shamatha on page 155. Following the realization of the ninth attentional balance, you are primed to achieve shamatha. The 9 preceding stages entail many incremental changes, but the actual accomplishment of shamatha involves a radical transition in your body and mind. You will be like a butterfly emerging from its cocoon. This shift is characterized by specific experiences that take place within a discrete, relatively brief period of time. According to accounts from the Indo-Tibetan tradition of Buddhism, the first sign of the achievement of shamatha is the experience of a sense of heaviness and numbness on the top of the head. This allegedly happens to anyone who experiences this transition, regardless of the specific method followed. It is said to feel as if a palm were being placed on the top of your head. It is not unpleasant or harmful, just unusual. Something remarkable must be taking place in the cortical region of your brain at this point, but so far no one has monitored the brain correlates of this shift using magnetic resonance imaging or an electroencephalograph. This physical sensation on the top of the head is symptomatic of a shift in your nervous system or network of vital energies that is correlated with gaining freedom from mental dysfunction, a general state of mental imbalance characterized by stiffness, rigidity, and unwieldiness. Consequently, you achieve a state of mental pliancy in which your mind is fit and supple like never before. From a contemplative perspective, when the mind is dysfunctional or prone to laxity and excitation, it is hard to generate enthusiasm for healing the afflictions of your mind, or for devoting yourself to virtuous mental activity. Once you are free of such mental dysfunction, you can focus your mind without resistance on any meaningful object or task, and such a mind is now set to be fit or serviceable. This is the key to achieving optimal mental performance. So this mental pliancy is symbolized by the meditator riding on the elephant of the mind, meaning that we can now turn the mind to whatever we want without any resistance whatsoever. Following this sense of pressure on the top of your head, you experience the movement of vital energies moving in your body. And when they have coursed everywhere throughout your body, you feel as if you are filled with the power of this dynamic energy. You are now freed of physical dysfunction, so your body feels buoyant and light like never before. So that's symbolized by the person flying through the sky. So it's said that when we achieve shamatha, again, our body feels light like cotton. So that's again symbolized by the meditator flying through the sky. Both your body and mind are now imbued with an exceptional degree of pliancy, which makes them remarkably fit for engaging in all kinds of mental training and other meaningful activities. When physical pliancy initially arises, the vital energies catalyze an extraordinary sense of physical bliss, which then triggers an equally exceptional experience of mental bliss. This rush of physical and mental rapture is transient, which is a good thing, for it so captivates the attention that you can do little else except enjoy it. Gradually it subsides, and you are now freed from the turbulence caused by this intense joy. Your attention settles down in perfect stability and clarity. You have now achieved shamatha. Sounds pretty good. One or two more things and then some questions. We see after shamatha, one more diagram in the top right-hand corner. So now we see the meditator on the elephant of the mind, and in their right hand is a sword. So this is a sword of wisdom. So this diagram is symbolizing Vipassana, the Vipassana practice. So now, based on our shamatha and a very clear, focused mind, we can really engage in the Vipassana practice and come to realize emptiness and cut through ignorance with the sword of wisdom. And that diagram has two numbers, 31 and 32. So if we look at opposite page at number 32 and 33, it says, the root of samsara is cut by the union of shamatha and vipassana observing emptiness. Equipped with mindfulness and introspection, seek the correct view of emptiness. So therefore, on the basis of shamatha, we can now really effectively engage in the vipassana practice. Now, what this does not mean, of course, is that we first need to achieve shamatha before we begin vipassana practice. We could be waiting a long time to begin vipassana practice otherwise. But what it does mean is that if we don't do some shamatha practice, meaning if our mind is completely distracted and dull, and then we engage in vipassana practice, we're probably not going to make much progress in the vipassana practice. So therefore, particularly we as a beginner, if our mind is not very focused, not very stable and clear, then we need to emphasize shamatha practice to make it more stable and clear so that we can have a better and better basis for engaging in vipassana practice. And then we can start some vipassana practice and then, of course, still keep working on our shamatha practice, getting better and better and better. But if we really want to have a direct realization of emptiness, then we need, as it says here, a union of shamatha and vipassana observing emptiness. So then for a direct realization of emptiness, we do need shamatha. One more thing I want to mention here, and then we'll maybe some questions. In the diagram, halfway up along the left, there's a tree and there's a monkey in the tree, number 19 underneath it. Monkey's grabbing some fruit. So if we look at number 19, it says, since virtuous thoughts are an interruption at the time of shamatha meditation, it is necessary to stop them. At other times, it is not necessary. What you're going to find in shamatha practice is as we start to get into this practice and your mind starts to get more calm, more clear, more focused, what you're going to find is all sorts of great ideas will start popping up. And maybe some very virtuous thoughts of loving kindness and compassion start to come up. And what this is saying is that that is not the right time to entertain these thoughts. Is that if some great idea comes up in shamatha, and you'll find the deeper you go into the practice, the more great ideas will keep coming up. But if you then entertain that, you go, oh, that's a great idea, and then start thinking about it, then we've lost the shamatha practice. So if a great idea comes up, then what we are to do is go, yes, very good idea. I'll attend to that after this meditation. And if you're worried about forgetting the great idea, you can even have a little notepad next to you, write down a couple of key words, and then put it aside and then keep going in your shamatha practice. Because otherwise, if you start entertaining these ideas, you're going to get blocked because the further you go, the more of these ideas will come up and then we'll get sort of stuck in our practice. So again, just acknowledge them and then say, yes, I'll attend to that after the meditation. So, okay. Question?
Maybe it's not really relevant. It's just out of personal interest.
Sure.
I know that people who do this kind of practice and I think who realize shamatha talk a lot about it. But I would like to know, have you ever met somebody personally who attended shamatha?
I'm sure I have, but have they gone around telling everyone that they've achieved it? No, but I'm pretty confident I've met a few people that have achieved shamatha. Because again, generally, when we progress in the spiritual path, one quality that we develop in a huge amount is humility. So if someone is walking around in public boasting about how they've achieved shamatha, they've realized emptiness and all this, there's a pretty high probability they're just completely deluding themselves.
Were they all monks or were they
also... we don't, and there's a, often there's this misconception that if we're serious about Buddhism and practice, we have to become a monk or nun. That's a complete misunderstanding. Historically, in ancient India and Tibet, probably was true, actually, because in ancient India and Tibet, most people were struggling to survive, to survive. And the only way that you'd actually even get access to any teachings is probably in a monastery or nunnery. And if you become a monk or a nun in those days, you had a roof over your head, you got fed, you got educated, everything was taken care of. So then, yes. And if you weren't a monk or a nun, you were just struggling to survive and you probably didn't have access to any teachers anyway, so really you couldn't begin to do anything. So historically, probably it was true that if you really wanted to practice in ancient India and Tibet, you probably did need to become monk or nun. Otherwise, it would be very difficult logistically. In the modern society, that's completely different. In fact, now, if you want to become a monk or a nun, and for some people, it could be the best way in the spiritual path, generally, and in ancient India and Tibet, of course, all the monasteries and nunneries were supported and funded by the communities. In the West, in our modern society, that doesn't exist. So even if you become a monk or a nun in the West, generally there's no monastery or nunnery you can go to. And even if there is, you probably have to pay yourself as well. And therefore, you probably have to work to support yourself. So the conditions are not there. And then often, of course, if you're wearing the robes in public, often you get a lot of negative attention as well, unfortunately, in our modern society. So a lot of things are not there that they used to be. But still, for some people in the modern society, becoming monk or nun could be the best approach. So we as an individual have to look at who, the type of person we are and work out which approach to following the spiritual path would work best for us. And there are many approaches to do, many ways of following the spiritual path. So we shouldn't get in the idea that if I'm serious about this, I have to become monk or nun. It's not the right way of thinking.
I remember you told us about the old script that saying for monks, it takes 3 months.
Oh, okay. How long does it take to achieve shamatha? Sometimes in the old texts, Indian and Tibetan texts, it says something like, if you're dull faculty, 9 months. Medium faculty, 6 months. Sharp faculty, 3 months. Sometimes you'll read this. But, of course, we need to remember that we have a completely different environment and background to in those days. And in Alan Wallace's book, he talks about, you know, how long would it take to achieve shamatha. And what he says is that modern studies have shown that in any high-level area of skill, whether it's technical skill or music or any, if you want to develop any high-level skill across the board, it takes minimum 5,000 hours of practice to become proficient in any area of skill, any. And if you want to become a master, you're looking at 10,000 hours of practice. If you want to be a concert pianist or some high-level technical ability, that's the amount of, and that studies show across the board, minimum 5,000 hours, 10,000 if you really want to become good at it. And Alan Wallace is suggesting maybe we're talking these sorts of numbers for shamatha. Why not?
So today there is no information about all the monasteries, the monk don't even must to pass through this level?
Sorry, I didn't understand your question.
Today the monks don't must to have shamatha to practice their...
Remember, generally monks and nuns in the monastery are doing a lot of study. They're studying in the monastery. And then if they want to meditate, they usually go off into a retreat somewhere. They're not usually doing long-term retreat in the monastery because it's too much activity, too much noise. So then when they finished all their education, which can take 10, 20 years, they may go decide to go and teach other younger monks or nuns, or they may go and teach outside, or they may go off somewhere in a retreat environment and meditate. So usually the long-term retreat is not happening in the monastery or nunnery.
How is maybe your honest views about going forward?
Yeah. So, and then we better break for lunch, is I like to use the analogy here of going to the gym. So let's say we go to the gym to get fit and we put in 6 months' effort and we get to a certain level of fitness. If we stop going to the gym, do we maintain that level of fitness? slowly it goes back. But if we go to the gym and do a minimum amount of effort, we can maintain that level. If we want to advance, we have to put more effort. But with a minimal amount of effort, we can maintain that level. Similarly here, if we put work for whatever time, particularly maybe doing some retreat and so forth, and we get to a certain level, if we stop meditating slowly like this, but then if we have a minimum amount of effort, and together with that would be having a conducive lifestyle, you can maintain that level. If you want to go further, of course, then more effort. So like that, in that way. Okay, let's stop there, break for lunch. And then in the afternoon session, we'll look at the Vipassana practice, the emptiness practice.